time to tell me the truth, to burden your mouth for what you say, and pieces of paper in the way. Welcome to Between the Lines, a monthly magazine program on the third Thursday of every month between 2 and 3 p.m. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper.
Can't continue pretending to choose these opposite sides on which we fall, loving you later as if at all. No right minds could wrong be this many times.
My guests today on Between the Lines are Brian Petty, a Greene County-based award-winning playwright, director and actor, and actor, writer and playwright Elizabeth Henry. Brian's play, Banshee, opens this weekend at the New York International Fringe Festival, a multimedia arts festival that's currently running in New York City. Brian, congratulations on getting your play accepted there.
I appreciate it.
Your plays have been produced in several off-Broadway houses. Most notably, you had Masquerade at the Cherry Lane Theatre. You were the winner of the Humboldt State University National Play Contest in California for a play called Next Year in Jerusalem. And your New York productions include Hindenburg, the musical, Everything's Coming Up Roses, Absolution, and Before the Parade Passes By.
Yes, Hindenburg was a comedy, just to get
right,
that out
in case the listeners are wondering there, yeah. And your Irish-themed play, On the Expectation of White Christmases, was shown at Columbia Green Community College, where it was called, quote, a riveting theatrical experience, end quote, by John Paul Keeler of Hudson Catskill Newspaper. So welcome to Between the Lines.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Let me ask you, Brian, is it a big deal getting a play accepted for the New York International Fringe?
Oh, it is to me. anytime I get a chance to get my plays done in New York, I always see it as an opportunity. You know, that's where the business is. That's where the agents who might be able to see your play and do something with it, or where production companies are congregated. So for me, it's a valuable opportunity to get my words out there and not only have a good production, which I'm sure we will, but to get a little head of steam up for my career.
How many people were you competing against? How competitive is this?
Well, I think there's 150 plays altogether. I don't know how many didn't make the cut, but the Fringe has a great reputation. They do it over in Scotland as well. And
That I'm very familiar with.
But. Yeah, it's so you know, you have people will know the International Fringe Festival from all parts of the globe, and it's a great thing to be selected. They usually go for a little more outrageous plays, you know, that from some of the titles, if you've seen them online, they're a little crazy. Ours isn't quite that outrageous, but I'm sure they took us because they liked what they saw and thought it would be marketable.
Now, your play is called Banshee, and we are going to hear a scene from it later on, but why don't you tell us a bit about what the play is about?
This play is about a man named Jerry Sullivan, who was actually, that was my uncle's name, and this character was based in part on my uncle. And his family called him Junior. He lives with his mother, and he's 40 years old, and he's had some mental problems. His mother, who is played by Elizabeth over here, has contributed to, I guess you would say. They don't have the healthiest of relationships. You look like you had something to say, Elizabeth. Jump
yes,
in any time.
Yes. Oh, no, that's okay.
Always the martyr.
Do feel free, Elizabeth.
She's my mom in the play. We have, I guess, a very caring but contentious relationship. The main character's brother gets him a new job and sets him up with a new girlfriend, and Jerry's mother, Kit, is not very happy about that situation. She feels very protective of him and doesn't want him to get hurt and to go with somebody that she doesn't think is appropriate for him. Is that right, Elizabeth?
That is absolutely correct.
Yep. So what would Kit be feeling? You tell me.
Kit is sure that the girl is unnecessary. And in fact, perhaps dangerous.
Mm-hmm. So there's a real conflict clearly going on here. This was based a lot on real life, I understand. I was doing a bit of reading on some of your blogs.
Oh, yeah.
About Jerry's actual story. My understanding is that this was your chance to perhaps give him a bit of a happy ending.
Yes. I had nothing but love and concern for my uncle and for my grandmother, who was not nearly as bad as the character that I made her into. It gave me a chance to look at that situation objectively and kind of be able to reassess it and to see, you know, what could have gone right for my uncle that would have given him a better life.
Give us a little bit of history about his actual life and what.
Sure. He was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic in the early 70s. He was in and out of institutions. He had worked as a Manhattan beat reporter for many years and, you know, had his name in the newspaper every day. You know, he was writing columns and, and news reports. And then he had a breakdown, and it was before my time, but it affected my family very much. And by the time I got to know my uncle, he was a different kind of person. Than what I had been told he was. He was trying to compensate for some of the problems that he was having, and I saw him go from, you know, being very talkative and arrogant even to then, near the end of his life, having no defenses at all and just being a very raw, open person. I always felt badly that his life turned out the way it did. It wasn't anybody's fault. It wasn't, you know, my grandmother's fault or his own fault or anybody else. It's just the way the cards were dealt. And he had this problem that he never quite got over. So that's a part of this play. That's certainly the background part of the character, is that Jerry was in a mental institution and does have that background. So when the idea of the Banshee comes up, and it's his mother who plants that idea, he's very willing to take it seriously, and it leads to a lot of conflict in the play.
So what exactly is the Banshee idea? Can you explain that a bit?
The Banshee is an Irish fairy tale. She screams at night, and if you hear that scream, someone in your family is going to die. That's the legend. She's often portrayed as a kind of a witch-like creature, you know. But when she screams, it's a sad scream. It's supposed to mean that
a wail.
Yeah, it's wailing, that she's crying, that she's already somebody's already dead. You know, that's her function. And it's Elizabeth in the play who first brings up the idea that the girlfriend might be a banshee.
And where does this come from, this idea?
Where does my character get the idea? She has a visitation from her deceased husband. But it's in her, too. You know, it's not as if, oh, that has to be explained to her. She's well-versed in these superstitions and in the folklore and myths of her ancestry. She's from Ireland. Also, if you need a quick idea about a banshee, you can always reference Darby O'Gill in The Little People by Walt Disney. Scared the out of me when
Bejesus.
I was...
Bejesus, I think.
Is that the radio term?
I was...
Oh, the clean radio term,
yes.
Bejesus.
I saw that, and Walt was not the same in my eyes after. It was terrifying. It was really a terrifying depiction back in the day, in the fossil record when I was a child.
No, but the motivation for Mum doing this is that she wants to keep the son at home. She wants to portray the girlfriend as this evil.
No.
There's many motivations.
No.
happens, and that's it's a very big part of the play. Is
I had a visitation.
She believes it.
Okay.
Completely. Mm-hmm. And the more that it's challenged, the more she digs in and says, "No, this happened. Your father came to me and said that word to me." Now, of course, she interprets it as being the girlfriend, and she has her own spin on the way everyone else sees that word. But one of the central parts of the play is who is to be believed, and is Junior going to go that way, believe what his mother said, or is she really just trying to torpedo this relationship that she sees as a threat?
And is the answer revealed, or are we left wondering at the end of the play?
I would say it's open to interpretation.
Open to interpretation.
At the very least, yes.
Okay. And we're going to take a break now, and we'll be coming back with a scene from Banshee, Brian's play, which is opening this Sunday at the New York International Fringe Festival.
Born before the wind, also younger than the sun. Yeah, the bonnie boat was won as we sail into the mystic. I can now hear the sailors cry. Smell the sea and feel the sky. Let your soul and spirit fly into the mystic. And where that foghorn blows, I will be coming home. Yeah, when the foghorn blows, I wanna hear it. I don't have to fear that I wanna rock your gypsy soul. Just like way back in the days of old. Yeah, magnificently we will fold into the mystic. That foghorn blows, you know I will be coming home. Yeah, when that foghorn whistle blows, I gotta hear it. I don't have to fear it. And I wanna rock your gypsy soul, just like way back in the day. Together we will float into the mystic. Come on, girl.
And you were just listening to Into the Mystic from Van Morrison's Moondance. And you're listening to Between the Lines with Anne Forbes Cooper. And my guests today are Elizabeth Henry, actor, playwright and writer, and Brian Petty, award-winning playwright, actor and director. And we're going to hear a scene from his new play called Banshee.
Relax, Ma.
But I saw him.
Come on, sit down.
He was right there, in the flesh.
Do you want some tea?
Tea? Sure, didn't I just come face to face with your father's ghost, and you expect me to drink a cup of tea?
Sorry, Ma.
Well, put it on, then. Oh, you should have seen him standing there at the end of me bed. His red hair was glowing like a lit match in a dark room. He had his hair again. He was wearing the suit we buried him in, except it had all its buttons, and there weren't any holes in it.
Maybe there's a tailor in heaven.
Don't you mock me. I tell you, I saw him. He had the same flower in his lapel, only now 'twere brilliant white, whiter than any white you've ever seen. It outshone the Sacred Heart of Jesus nightlight over me bed.
Jeez, that thing's like a lighthouse beacon.
Don't I know it? I tell you, he took me breath away. I'm finding it hard to breathe still.
That might be the 2 packs a day, Ma.
I should have never told you. I should have stayed in there with the spirit and let him drag me away to kingdom come. At least then I wouldn't have to suffer your fresh mouth. Look at these hands shaking like a leaf. Would cigarettes be making me do that? My nerves half worn away and all you can do is stand there and crack wise. What have I done to deserve such a fate? Is the tea done?
Almost, Ma. Now listen, when you saw Pop, you looked pretty good, right? And that's not a bad thing. Maybe he just popped in to let you know he was okay. Maybe he was just checking up on you. It doesn't have to be all gloom and doom, you know.
Sure, he wasn't in your room. You didn't have to hear his voice.
He spoke to you? What did he say?
Nothing important.
Ma.
Now you take it for earnest, do you? Now it's not a figment of my imagination.
I never said it was, Ma.
Twere implied. I'm just a crazy old bat you'll be shipping off to a home someday soon.
Ma, I gotta be up at 6 tomorrow.
Sure, you go get your sleep. You and that girl can be doing God knows what in me kitchen until all hours. But God forbid your own mother is scared out of her wits at an inconvenient time of day.
Ma, will you just tell me what Pop said?
I don't think I should.
Why not?
You won't like it.
What won't I like? Did he say something about me?
What does it matter anyway? It's all in me head.
Enough, Ma. Tell me what he said about me.
Oh, he said nothing about you.
About who, then?
I'm not exactly sure. I have me suspicions, mind you.
For God's sake, Ma, would you tell me what he said?
Just one word. Banshee.
Banshee?
Shh! Stifle yourself, she might hear you.
Ma, it was just a dream.
Oh, no. No, no, no. It was a visitation.
What's the difference?
Your father, God rest his soul and committed to heaven, appeared to me for a good reason. He means to warn me.
About a banshee?
For Christ's sake, keep your voice down. Would you tempt the devil himself?
Aren't they supposed to be out haunting in the woods somewhere? What would one be doing in a fourth floor walk-up?
How should I know? Sure, I wasn't the one who brought it up.
Well, maybe you heard wrong. I mean, could Pop have said bedsheets instead?
Are you daft? Sure, why would the man be talking about bedsheets? Didn't I make the bed every day for 40 years? Now, in the hereafter, he decides he wants to come and talk to me about the sheets.
All right. But maybe he said something else entirely.
I know what the man said. He said that word, clear as a bell. He looked straight into me. Sure, I can still see the ocean blue of his eyes whenever I close me own. It's like they were trying to say something to me, but they lacked the voice to do so. He was warning me, I tell you. He was determined to get that one word out with all the breath he had left. I felt him struggling. After all those years of marriage, you know when the man is trying to impart something important. Oh, I can hardly stop myself from shaking just thinking about it.
All right, Ma. Have a sip of tea. So, Pop came back to warn you about that word. What do you think he meant by it?
You don't understand.
Understand what?
I knew I shouldn't have told you.
When did you know that? When you woke me up from a dead sleep? What does it mean, Ma?
The banshee. She's a woman.
You're like a witch.
No, not like a witch altogether. She's a spirit, a vengeful harbinger of death. She comes like the wind in the trees and souls are destroyed in her wake. When she screams that horrible, cursed howl of hers, not a soul can hope to survive her.
And?
It's that girl.
Who? You mean Kara?
Yes.
Oh, for the love of all that's holy, Ma.
Well, who else could it be?
Well, how about anybody else in the world?
She's the only one. It makes sense.
Why? Because you don't like her?
I don't dislike the girl. Sure, I wouldn't have an unkind word to say about her altogether if she weren't trying to steal your soul.
It was a dream, Ma. Kara is not a banshee.
Oh, Jesus, Mary and Joseph.
Banshee, banshee, come get me.
Oh, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women.
Look at me, Ma.
Don't interrupt me. I'm praying.
Tell Mary you'll get back to her.
Don't you dare laugh at me visitation at your own peril, but don't you ever make light of me religion. If you had more prayer in your life, maybe you wouldn't have...
Wouldn't have what, Ma?
Wouldn't have had so much pain in your life. Wouldn't have brought this scourge upon yourself.
I know what my scourge is.
Sure, what might you mean by that?
Nothing, Ma.
Don't tell me nothing. I have ears enough to hear. Is that what they taught you in that place? How to lay all your troubles at your mother's feet? What have I ever done but try to help you? Sure, aren't I trying to do such right now?
By telling me my girlfriend's a monster?
By passing on your father's warning. Do you think I asked him to come to me in the middle of the night and say what he said? Sure, what am I? But the messenger...
I'm going back to bed.
After the fright I had, would you leave me here to face kingdom come with nothing but a cup of tea?
You want toast too?
Honor thy mother. May God forgive your acid tongue.
Yeah, I don't think he's been in a forgiving mood lately.
Oh, so now everything is God's fault.
No, Ma. It's all my fault. I put myself exactly where I ended up. But somehow, here I am on the other side. And for the first time in years, it feels like I might be able to get back all that time that I lost. So what happens? My mother insists that my girlfriend is a mythical Irish harbinger of death who's intent on destroying my soul. I don't know if God is behind this little development, but if he is, he certainly has a fantastic sense of irony. So if it's all the same to you, I think I'll retreat to my bed and try to reassemble the shambles of my life.
Haven't you forgotten something?
What's that, Ma?
Me toast.
That was absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Who's the banshee now?
And you've just been listening to a scene from Banshee, a new play by Brian Petty, which opens at the New York Fringe International Festival this Sunday, starring Elizabeth Henry and directed by...
Mary Ellen Nelligar.
Thank you. And
starring Brian Christopher.
Yes, please and say who the other actors are.
Yes, there's Brian Christopher. There's Ron Moorhead, Elizabeth Henry, Lauren Murphy, Matt Meinson. And our co-director is Jim Pillmeyer, and our producer is Cynthia Topps.
And our stage manager is...
Julie Novak.
Julie Novak and Rebecca... Rebecca, we don't know Rebecca's last name. She's always there. She's always fabulous, but we don't know her last name. But this is an incredible cast. I mean, every single person is great, like great fun, and so talented. It's really exciting.
Yes, I hope you come out and see us.
Okay, so really exciting theater there. And again, that is Banshee, that is opening this weekend. So why don't you tell us the date?
Sure. We're going to be at the Flamboyant Theater, which is 107 Suffolk Street in New York City. And we're Sunday, August 21st at 8:45 p.m., Monday, August 22nd at 5:45 p.m., Wednesday, August 24th at 2 p.m., Thursday, August 25th at 9 p.m., and Saturday, August 27th, is our closing at noon. And the number to call for tickets is 866-468-7619 or go on www.fringenewyorkcity.com at fringenyc.org, I should say.
And we'll be right back after the break with more with Brian Petty and Elizabeth Henry. Stay tuned. And you were listening to Sinead O'Connor on The Long Black Veil with the Chieftains. And you're back listening to Between the Lines with Anne Forbes Cooper. And my guests today are Brian Petty and Elizabeth Henry. You two have worked together quite a lot in the past. What else have you worked on?
Brian's play, 10 Seconds, which is very grounded, very different than this. This play has lots of almost supernatural feeling to it. 10 Seconds is very current, could be happening at the park with kids and fathers and mothers.
That was a one-act play that we did at Dragonfly as part of their one-act festival. It was about a fight between a young man who had mental problems and this man who was a softball player, and there was a misunderstanding, and they end up in a physical fight. And Elizabeth played the younger man's mother. And now that this man was facing prosecution for what he did, and they have the bulk of the play was a scene between the three characters where they kind of come to some kind of understanding with each other. And that was the first time I had ever worked with Elizabeth, and I was overjoyed to have her as part of our team, because I loved the way she handled that role. And I'd gotten a chance since then to see her writing, and then with this role, me and Mary Ellen, who is directing.
Your wife?
Yes.
We should introduce the very important person, the director.
Yeah.
Mary Ellen Neligar?
Yes. She was directing this from the very start. She's directed a few of my other original plays in the past, and she wanted Elizabeth from the very beginning, and I agreed. I thought that she would be perfect for this role, and indeed she is.
So, Elizabeth, what do you like about working with Ryan?
Well, the writing is wonderful, which is such a privilege to be working with the actual living person who wrote the words, and that the words are so wonderful. I mean, you know, as a writer myself, I would be happy to help anyone, you know, to work with people. It's a part of the process, especially with performance writing. But Brian's work is so developed and so rich, and it's there. It's all there. It's really not like working with developing work. It's all there. And there's a emotional depth, but it is classically good writing. There's nothing that's kind of avant-garde and you go along with it. You know what I mean? It's just not like that at all. It's there. It's classically good writing. And the story is there. The characters are there. The subcontext is there. It's just wonderful writing. And he chooses great subjects. And the way his mind works is wonderful. Like Next Year in Jerusalem came sort of almost spontaneously to him through discussions with Marielle, his wife, and he just kind of, it bubbled up in him, and he just went off and did it. And it's, you know, so it's just it's very inspiring for me as a writer, and it's just great opportunity as an actress to do this stuff with him too. I mean, he's right there. So.
And if you've just joined us, you're listening to Anne Forbes Cooper on Between the Lines, and my guest today are Elizabeth Henry, actor, writer, playwright, and Brian Petty, award-winning playwright and actor and director. I want to get back to something that we touched on earlier. When it comes to setting, where is Banshee set?
Banshee is set in particular time in the Chelsea section in New York City. It's 1981, which I chose for a couple of reasons. One is that the baseball strike was that year. Jerry's character is a huge Yankee fan, and also because it put the characters age-wise where I wanted them, you know, in a time and place that I could reach back and remember pretty clearly.
Where exactly? You said it's Chelsea, but does it all take part in one set, or?
It moves around a little bit. He works down at the docks on the west side, so that's part of the scenery. Most of it takes place in their kitchen, which was, you know, kind of the hub of every Irish family that I ever knew. You know, everything happened in the kitchen. Everybody talked in the kitchen. And there's other little places. We're on a limited set budget. The place that we are at the Flamboyant Theater, it's meant for limited sets. So a lot of it is just take our word for it. This is where we are, which I guess brings the focus to the acting and the writing, which is where we wanted it.
And I also read that one of your influences was Conor McPherson, the Irish playwright.
Yes,
and
very much so.
You referenced his play The Weir, mm-hmm. which pretty much everything takes place in a bar. With
the storytelling aspect that he has, which I think is so wonderful, and the fact that he's not afraid to write monologues. He doesn't feel a need to create action where there isn't any. You know, sometimes just listening to someone tell a story creates the action. He has no qualms about that. If he wants his people to tell a story that takes three minutes long, they're going to tell that story, and you're going to be riveted as an audience member. Mary Ellen and I saw The Weir on Broadway when she was pregnant with our first child, and we ended up naming him Connor. So it's a deep respect that I have both for the types of subject matter that he tackles, which, you know, Banshee is definitely right out of that genre, kind of mystical Irish genre that he plays in so well. And also the way he has Irish people talk like Irish people. And my grandmother had a brogue, and she was an Irish person, and that's, you know, that's, I wrote her to be, to sound like that.
I saw that play too on Broadway. I don't know if we were there at the same night.
We probably were.
Yeah,
Kismet.
Yeah, it's crazy, but it's a wonderful piece. And I have to say too, to go back to what I said before about Brian's writing, it is possible to sustain that tension and interest in something if the writing is very good. And certainly The Weir is fabulous, and Brian's writing. Brian cares about the writing, and it shows.
I saw it too, but not on Broadway. I saw it in Scotland.
Oh, wow. That must have been something else.
Yeah.
They used to do it in bars, if I remember. And there's some scenes in there that are very, very personal. Yeah. And I read Conor McPherson talk about that, and he said that people would pass out at the bar, you know, just from the intensity of it. So, I mean, that's where he came from. He wrote plays that were put up in bars, you know. That was his background, and I love that idea about it. That, you know, it doesn't have to be it's not a movie, you know. It doesn't have to be a bomb drop at the end.
There's no car chases
no.
in Banshee.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of action, but it's not the type of action that, you know, you'd see in a Harrison Ford movie, I guess.
This leads me to ask about the importance of the Irish theme in your writing. You are Irish. You were born where?
I'm a second generation Irish. I was born in Manhattan, but we only stayed there for a couple of years. And I mostly grew up in Rockland County. I'm half Italian as well, but the Irish side of my family, it was the part of our family that we saw the most and we connected with the most. We went to see them and saw where they live, and, you know, they were a part of our lives a lot. So these people were very important to me. A lot of who I am came from listening at that kitchen table. A lot of that was imbued by first generation Irish-born grandparents, you know, who had a certain take on the world and had certain values that I learned at their knee.
And also, you live near East Durham.
Yes,
of course. It
in
to
Durham,
be...
actually,
in
and,
Durham,
and
okay,
minutes away from East Durham. Yes, by happy accident, we ended up in the Irish Catskills. So,
was that really a happy accident, or is there something underlying going on here?
Well, it was. We've had some tough times with living in this area. I won't lie to you, but it's a beautiful part of the country, and my wife is full Irish, and you know, we have our son Connor and Michael, you know, so we have very Gaelic names. So we do identify to a great degree with the Irish side of our family.
Do you think that if you're an Irish writer, it's inevitable that you write about Irish subjects?
I guess it all starts with James Joyce, and he could never get over his Irish upbringing, you know. His Catholicism and the Irish politics, it imbued everything that he did. Now, I've written about a Holocaust victim. I've written about a German boxer. I don't feel like this is all... I have to write about everything Irish themed. It just so happened that this one was.
And 10 seconds had...
Yeah, that didn't have anything to do. But, you know, you know, the old adage is you write what you know. And if you're writing something about your family or based on members of your family, you know, if my family was Irish, that's who they were. And that definitely is a part of me. And if I'm bringing myself to bear on the work, that's going to end up in there.
Apart from Conor McPherson, who else do you admire?
Eugene O'Neill is a lot of the classic playwrights. Arthur Miller. I'm kind of a throwback as far as my art goes, in that I like structure and I like development of characters. I'm not huge on some of the other modernist movements that have happened since then. I'm kind of getting back to what Conor McPherson's doing, you know, trying to write classic plays with an edge of you know, right now to them, you know, and try to struggle with, you know, what the things that are happening now, but using that structure that I am very comfortable in. For me, you know, give me Long Day's Journey into Night. Let me sink my teeth into it, you know, and see some real character development and real human emotions. And that's what I get excited about.
We mentioned earlier your wife, who is the director of this play, and she directs a lot of plays. You obviously like to keep it in the family.
You know, when it's something as personal as the first try at your play or the premiere of your play, if I have any control over it, I don't always like to be in it. In fact, most of the time I'm not. But I like to either direct it or have Mary Ellen direct it, because I know that we share a similar sensibility. With Mary Ellen, I know she directed the play I mentioned about the German boxer called The Measure of a Man in Rhinebeck a few years ago, and she just did a fantastic job. And she co-directed Next Year in Jerusalem when we first did it. I trust that she's going to keep it in the direction where I'm comfortable with it. And if she wants to go outside of that direction, you know, she'll explain it to me, and we have a great working relationship that way.
What about the kids? Are the kids involved as well?
The kids were in The Measure of a Man, or one of them, I should say. My stepson James and my son Connor were in that. Michael hasn't hit the stage in one of my plays yet, but the time is coming. My stepson James was also in 10 Seconds as well. So yeah, we're raising a troupe of nasty little
potential
actors.
So can you make a living out of it?
Oh, no. God, no. You do this, don't you? it's John Guare is another playwright that I respect a lot, and he didn't have his first real monetary successes, until he was well into his 40s. He was interviewed one time, and he said, "It's nothing that I did different. I've been just doing what I've been doing for years. It's just everybody caught up to me." And that's kind of the way I feel, is I'm doing what I love. I'm doing my job, and that is to write new plays and to write interesting plays. And if the time comes when that's noticed and appreciated, I have to do things like this, you know, and get the word out and say, "Hey, come see my play," you know, and send them out as I do all the time. It'd be great if I could make a living at it, but that's not my primary concern. I do truly feel that way, that this is something I would do if I had a piece of paper and no place to live. So,
until the rest of the world catches up with you anyway. Okay. And you've just joined us. You're listening to Anne Forbes Cooper on Between the Lines, and my guest today are Elizabeth Henry, actor, writer, playwright, and Brian Petty, award-winning playwright and actor and director. Okay. Elizabeth, I didn't mean to exclude you from the conversation, because you also have a very storied history and background.
Oh, yes. You've heard.
Why don't you fill us in a little on the kind of plays that you have done?
My theatrical experience is mostly as an actress. I started acting because back in the day when cable TV first became a fact, I was waitressing in New York City, and some actresses said to me, "We could get a gig writing a script for cable TV. Would you write it?" So I agreed, and then proceeded to be driven nuts by these actresses who were talking about things in a way that I didn't understand. So I swore after that I would learn that craft so I could work with actresses and actors. And when I went to study as an observer, the instructor said, "Oh, no. You come to this class. I don't care what you do on your own time. You're working, and get up there." So I began acting, and it really was an amazing experience for me, in that I really regret that I hadn't started sooner, because I really love it. I really love it. I studied and did a little work in New York City, and then my husband and I decided to start our family. So that became the most important thing for me. But I did community theater locally in Hunter, around, began writing. I've always been a writer. I did a lot of writing in New York City. And I did a lot of writing for that acting instructor. I would write scenes and monologues for her students. But I have been writing on a particular subject for some time, and Brian's helping me with that.
It's about Maude Adams, who was in Peter Pan.
Yes, she's the first Peter Pan. She was the original Peter Pan.
For the little that I've seen of it, which is about four or five scenes, is fantastic. I can't wait to see it actually.
It was such a great time to be in the theater. I mean, she was a contemporary of Sarah Bernhardt and Ethel Barrymore. It was just a wonderful time to be in the theater. It was the golden age of theater. And there were just wonderful things about it. Researching it is fabulous.
I can attest to that because, of course, I've been privy to listening to some of these scenes too, because we're all actually in the same playwriting mm-hmm. workshop. Brian also runs a playwriting workshop. Where do you just mention?
Oh, sure. We've been doing it for about, I guess, 4 or 5 months now, and it originated at Dragonfly in Cairo. And unfortunately, we had to relocate from there. And I've been doing it mostly in my living room since. We try to do at least once a month get together and with some playwrights who have either come to join the group or we know. And it ends up being good. You know, you bring 10 minutes of your work to read. And we all respond to that 10 minutes and try to, you know, just give our honest reaction to it. And it's, you know, it's meant to be a place that's safe to come and to explore your work and to get honest criticism and feedback about it. And I'm happy with it for what it is, you know, that it's a safe place to come for some playwright friends of mine and for me myself, where we can throw some ideas against the wall.
So if there's any budding playwrights out there, Brian, how do they get in touch with you?
Best way would be email. I'm at bcpkid@gmail.com. And if you're interested, drop us a line, and I'll put you on our mailing list. And if you can make your way out to Durham, we'd be glad to have you.
And thank you so much for being on Between the Lines,
thank
Elizabeth
you, Anne.
And Brian. And that's my show for today. Thank you for listening. I'll be back next month, the same time, the third Thursday of every month, from 2 to 3 p.m. And here is Sarah Bareilles singing Between the Lines to take us out.
Memory is cruel, queen of attentions and details, defending intentions if he fails. Until now, familiar in a way that I could have sworn I'd heard him say it 10,000 times. Oh, if only I had been listening. Leave unsaid, unspoken, eyes wide shut.
Mm-hmm.